Good afternoon. We'll call this meeting of the House Fisheries Committee to order. The time is 12:01 p.m. Members present at this time, Representative Andy Story, Representative Dan Ortiz, and myself, Representative Tarr. We're starting in a very abbreviated fashion because we have to go back to the floor in 15 minutes. But we know that you came to town for this presentation, and so we're very appreciative of your effort to come to Juneau. And so I'm sorry that it'll be very abbreviated, but we definitely wanted to hear from you. And then the bill that was going to be under consideration today, we would like to recess, and then we'll see how the floor session goes if we're able to reconvene. And again, my sincere apologies for the inconvenience. Please let the record reflect that Representative McCabe has joined us. Thank you to the folks from the LIO, Shannon McCain and Doug Bridges, and then Ivan, I know that's you. Thank you back there. The first presentation here, the Skipper Science Program, we have Lindsay Bloom, campaign strategist for Salmon State, and Christopher Tran, Pribilof Island science technician, Aleut Community of St. Paul Island Tribal Government. So we'd love to turn it over to you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Tarr, and hopefully we're close enough here. So good morning again, and just for the record, Lindsay Bloom. I work with an organization based here in Juneau called Salmon State. I was born and raised here on Tlingit lands in Zantakahini, and I've been involved in commercial fishing my whole life, both here in Southeast Alaska and then also up in Bristol Bay. And that is sort of the commercial fishing side of things to the Skipper Science Project. And then Chris, I'll let you introduce yourself. And Chris is a scientist, so you'll hear that theme as we go here.
Thank you, Lindsay. My name is Christopher Tran, for the record. I work out of Anchorage, Alaska, the Nina Lands. And thank you for having us today.
So we're gonna try to fly along here, and then also would love if there's any like specific questions. Chris and I are around the next couple days, and we're happy to meet with committee members to keep talking about this really cool program called Skipper Science. So Skipper Science is a partnership that we have created. We kind of joke that it's a bit of like a dating app between commercial fishermen and scientists in terms of pairing up our communities. And I think it's got a lot of benefits for the state of Alaska. And we're here today to talk about it. And then what we're really working on right now is to continue to secure support and funding and just participation in the program going forward. So it takes advantage of the fact that fishermen are eyes and ears out on the water 365 days a year throughout the 46,000 miles of coastline that we have here in Alaska, and really trying to figure out how we can take better advantage of that in utilizing those fishing vessels also as research platforms and points of observation for what's going on in our fisheries and also what's going on in our environment in general. I think it can create a lot of cost savings in terms of, we all know, you know, there's been a lot of news about the big Arctic research voyage going on right now, which is important, but research can be very expensive, and this might be a way, kind of like a win-win, where we can save money and create a new revenue stream for fishermen and compensate them for the work that they're doing. And the really cool thing that I'm excited about with this is that it's all done through a smartphone app. And I'm gonna play a short video here, and this is just like a demo, I think. We're gonna allow it. If not, I'll just explain it. This is like a demo of the app. If we don't get the video to play, I think we're going to get it to play. And while it's starting, what you would do is you could all do this right now. I'd invite you to, if you'd like to. You can take out your smartphone. You can go to your app store. This could be like a Apple phone or an Android. You would search ISN Skipper Science and find the app will pop up. And so this is what we're having fishermen do who join the program. They download it, and that's kind of that. Once they sign up, we're just going to skip it. I'm happy to give you a demo off my phone in a little bit. So once they sign up, They're given like a username and a password. We do recognize that fishermen are pretty sensitive about sharing their information, especially their best fishing holes and this kind of thing. So we have a lot of data agreements that people sign before they participate in the program, promising we're not going to give it away or publish it in any way without their consent and information. I'll let you just talk a little more about the background.
Yeah, so this is our core team. I won't bother naming all our names here, but you can see that we have Salmon Habitat Information Program, Lindsay, other community, St. Paul Island, Ocean Bering Sea Initiative and Northern Latitudes Partnerships and Alaska Ocean Observing Systems who have supported this effort thus far and see the potential for this tool for the betterment of research and decision making in Alaska. To give a little background, Skipper Science is actually an expansion of the Indigenous Sentinels Network that's been operating for 20 years in remote Alaska communities. It was born out of a need from our community to document and record the observations our community members were experiencing. And so initially it was on paper forms, but it evolved into a web and app-based tool with an online database that was designed for non-scientists recording in remote locations systematically with rigorous data standards. We have checks and balances, quality insurance, and there's also the app requires no internet to collect the data. It can be saved on the phone, and then when you're in Wi-Fi range, you can upload it to the database. And we start. It was originally called the Bering Watch Program, but we expanded out of the Bering Sea throughout Alaska, and that was partially because of the strength of the flexibility and the customization of the app. We're able to modify data forms to collect the needs of the users and also adapt it based on feedback from users. It was also important for us to incorporate an Indigenous traditional and lawful knowledge addition to the recording of and such as anomalies that were observed that may have been different from the past. And so we've had collaborations with scientists from the University of Victoria, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, with the Tanana Chiefs Conference region, collecting moose and salmon that kind of modified to meet those needs. And then that eventually expanded to Skipper Science, and that the original pilot project was actually back in 2016. And the story is that an Alaska vessel captain recognized that Skipper Science is a discipline that is in other parts of the world, and that it is used in science and in partnerships with industry, and there's ways of recording and documenting that. And so we had a pilot project just in the Bering Sea region in 2016 and created this field guide. And then in 2021, we had the fortune of rebranding it, reimagining it, and getting support, as you can see from all these organizations and media attention that we've recognized the potential for this tool to amplify the voices of fishermen and Alaskan coastal communities. And I'll hand it off to Lindsay for a result of our 2021 pilot project.
So I'm sure we've all had that experience where you have a really great idea and then you go to a group of people and you're like, I have this really great idea. And they're like, that so already exists. And so that was kind of the deal with Skipper Science. It was like, oh, we're seeing these headlines about, you know, trawlers in Southeast seeing sea turtles for the first time and all these different sort of like, maybe climate related, like ecological changes. And it was like, what if we could log it all in a database and give it to, you know, scientists and fisheries managers. And the smarter folks at the Elliott Community of St. Paul Island were like, yeah, we already got it. And so that was how this partnership for 2021 really came together. And we said, okay, well, let's see if fishermen will actually do this. Like, can we actually get them to, you know, download the app and create all their stuff and log some data? And so that's what we set out to do. And we had fantastic results. I'm going to skip this one in the interest of time. For 2021, we didn't have, you know, the multi-million dollar grant funding that we hope to have in the future to support this. And so we had to hustle a little extra to get fishermen aware of it and to get them participating. And so we had some different incentives and things for them to do that. And we got 100 fishermen to sign up. We had amazing support, both from just reporters who were sort of interested and willing to write about the story, as well as the commercial fishing industry was just all about it. They contributed financially, as well as sending emails to their fleets, encouraging people to participate and that kind of thing. So it was pretty fantastic. This is just an example of like an observation that was made. I guess somebody took a picture of one of their salmon with some sea lice on it. Maybe that's normal. Maybe that's not. We're not asking fishermen to discern like what the observations mean, but just to make observations and start building, you know, the baseline and see what we could do here. So this is showing you some of the locations where people were observing. Shout out for Sitka. They had the most fishermen there making observations. The kinds of things that people observed, everything from horseflies to marine mammals, seabirds, sharks, turtles, and a lot of just weather. And so overall, we felt like the program was a huge success, and we think it has incredible potential going forward, and we're really looking forward to fine-tuning it. One of the things that happened all summer long is fishermen were calling, or we were like texting them and saying, hey, you haven't made an observation, and they forgot their password or they forgot their username. And so this year we have these little like plastic cards that look like a fishing permit. You can put it right in there and you write your username and password on it so that you don't forget going forward. And there will be some more tweaks to the software, just in terms of getting people using the internal GPS more rather than trying to type in coordinates, making more videos and things for fishermen to just have an easier time with it. But overall, we learned it's totally doable. They'll totally do it. And the scientific community is also very receptive.
We hosted, and just about a month and a half ago, we hosted a workshop to match scientists and fishermen, and that just showed, it was widely attended, and it was a very productive, and it showed the excitement towards the future of this tool. We had agency scientists from Natural Park Service, NOAA, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and a broad representation from the fishing community. And we identified goals moving forward, such as maybe focusing on the need or recognizing metrics that both communities would like to gather, like sea surface temperature, walrus haulouts, seabird die-offs, changes in species distribution. And we're drafting a report that will inform the future of skipper science right now. So the next steps, we hope to expand the program, increase the number of participants and the frequency of participation, establish additional long-term funding and to secure fisherman compensation. That was one of the key points identified during the workshop, is to find a more streamlined, develop a more streamlined method to compensate fishermen, and expand and solidify partnership with NOAA, Alaska Department of Fish and Game, and other scientific bodies. Overall, to amplify the voices of fishermen in research and decision-making. Yeah. Anything to add?
No, just we hear the bells. Thank you so much for squeezing us in, and we'll follow up with Fisheries Committee members to talk a little bit more about next steps as well.
Thank you, Lindsay. Thank you, Chris. Thank you so much. We did everything we could with the 12 or 13 minutes we had. So thank you so much. Please let the record reflect that Representative Vance joined us at 12:02. We'll go ahead and recess this meeting. We'll see what's happening on the floor and whether we can get to the bill that we had scheduled today as well. So we are at recess.
Thank you again.
We'll reconvene our earlier meeting. The time is 1:37 p.m. Thank you again to our earlier presenters who took probably a 40-minute presentation and packed it into 15 minutes. That was Christopher Tran from Pribilof Island Science, Pribilof Island Science Technician from the Aleut Community of St. Paul Island Tribal Government, and Lindsay Bloom from Salmon State. So thank you to both of them for that great presentation on the Skipper Science Program, and we look forward to talking with you more about that as time goes on. We're going to transition to the first hearing of House Bill 397, State Ownership of Submerged Land. This is one of the governor's bills. Joining us today, and thank you for coming to Juneau, and so I'm glad we can at least have this introductory meeting under the sort of unusual circumstances. So we have Deputy Commissioner Brett Goodrum from the Department of Natural Resources, Jim Walker, Manager of Public Access Assertion and Defense, I believe also DNR. And then available for questions, let's just see online. We have Jesse Alloway, the Solicitor General, Department of Law, and then Ben Mulligan, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Fish and Game. So we'll turn it over to you. Can you let us know if you prefer to hold questions till the end or if we can do questions on each slide? And Representative Vance, thank you for joining us. We're just getting started.
Good afternoon, Chair Tarr and members of the committee. For the record, I am Brent Goodrum, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Natural Resources. To answer your question real quickly, I think we can take questions on the fly, if that's helpful. That way we keep everyone oriented and moving at pace with us. As you mentioned, I am joined here at the table by Jim Walker, who is the Section Leader of the Public Access Assertion and Defense Unit within the Department of Natural Resources. And as you mentioned earlier, again, additionally online for possible questions, we have Deputy Commissioner Ben Mulligan from Department of Fish and Game and Solicitor General Jesse Alloway from Department of Law. We thank you for your time and appreciate the opportunity to present HB 397 that principally deals with the identification and codification of state submerged lands in federal areas. Of all the legislation that comes before this committee, this legislative session, action on this piece of legislation could be the most impactful with regards to how Alaska citizens for generations to come understand and finally fully realize the hard-earned rights achieved at the time of statehood. Alaska, a state entitled as of 1959 to all the incidents of ownership in its navigable rivers and lakes, yet still deprived of clear title some 63 years later, is effectively deprived of what it's entitled to under the Equal Footing Doctrine. Nonetheless, the state doggedly presses forward to assert these rights, still within our grasp, and are worth fighting for, even some 63 years later. The current status quo of uncertainty and ambiguity of ownership, management, and control of our state's navigable water bodies is simply not in our state's best interest. I don't believe it's in anyone's best interest. For 63 years, we have patiently waited for federal authorities to make their declarations known to us with regards to the navigability of water bodies. At this glacial pace, we would need to wait hundreds of years more for them to break their self-induced silence. Taking this same linear approach for even one day longer and expecting a different result or response from our federal counterparts is simply not good land management. The time is now for us to flip the script. We need to lead. We, the state of Alaska, need to decisively take action to identify and codify our navigable rivers and lakes for current and future generations of Alaskans in all who come to our great state so they confidently know with whom ownership, management, and control rightly rests. After all, at the end of the day, the state ought to be able to manage its property, fully knowing what its property is. And that's where you all come in. Jim.
Thank you, Chair Tarr, members of the House Fisheries Committee. My name is Jim Walker. I am employed as the section leader for the Public Access Assertion and Defense Section within the Division of Mining, Land, and Water of the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. Pleasure to be with you this afternoon and to present an overview of House Bill 397. If I may step back and identify what it is that this particular bill addresses. Specifically, it is our best estimate. Oh, I'm sorry. Is this better? It is our best estimate that Alaska has approximately 800,000 miles of navigable rivers. It also has an estimated acreage of 30 million acres of navigable lakes statewide. And pursuant to the Equal Footing Doctrine, the Alaska Statehood Act, as well as the Federal Submerged Lands Act, as Brent Goodrum just indicated, Alaska owns the submerged lands under every navigable, in fact, river and lake, and every tidally influenced water within the state, unless a valid pre-statehood withdrawal explicitly and expressly removes those submerged lands from state ownership. This is one of the fundamental promises of statehood made to Alaska. And what does this mean for federal areas within the state, which are specifically addressed with this legislation? And that means that if it is a federal CSU that was created post-statehood, the state owns the submerged lands.
Before we go on, can I just ask a question? So the two things you've referenced so far, the Equal Footing Doctrine from the Alaska Statehood Act and the Federal Submerged Lands Act, can you just briefly expound on both of those just to get it into the context of today's conversation?
Absolutely. And I will also look to Jesse Alloway, who's on the phone, to further expand on the legal aspects if I do not do them justice. But the Equal Footing Doctrine of the United States Constitution provides that every state that enters the Union after the original colonies enters on the same footing. They get the same deal that the original colonies got. And one aspect of that is the state, the new state, will own the submerged lands under every navigable, in fact, water and every tidally influenced water in the state. Why is that important? One of the reasons that it's important is that when a new state enters the United States, you do not want the new state to be a ward of the rest of the United States. You want it to be able to stand on its own feet financially and otherwise, so that every state that enters the United States after these original colonies enters on the same footing. So everything that we ask for and everything that is contained within this legislation is exactly the same deal that the other 49 states in the United States enjoyed. The Federal Submerged Lands Act, as well as the Alaska Statehood Act, build on those comments that I just made to make explicit who owns the submerged lands within the state of Alaska.
Thank you. And Representative Christ-Tompkins is online. So Representative Christ-Tompkins, if you have any questions, please chime in, and I'll try to remember to ask you as well. And then I'm not sure if it's Ms. or Mr. Alloway, but are there any additional comments you'd like to add at this time?
Thank you, Chair Tarr. This is Jesse Alloway from the Department of Law. The only thing that I'd add is that the Submerged Lands Act does expand on the Equal Footing Doctrine a little bit. So under the Equal Footing Doctrine, you would get the low, the mean high line to the low mean high line of the tidal waters. And the Submerged Lands Act says that you get to extend that out 3 miles from the coastline. So why it's important for us to mention the Submerged Lands Act is because it gives us that little bit of extra of the tide lens. So we always say you get the navigable waters under the equal footing doctrine, and then you get additional tide lens under the Submerged Lands Act. And then the Alaska Statehood Act makes it clear that once the state entered the union, we got both of those various components, the navigable waters as well as the tide lens. That's it. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. And does anyone else have any questions at this time? Okay, please continue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Tarr. Going back to the slide that we're looking at, these are areas within the state of Alaska that were added to or created post-statehood. And so in all of these areas, any of the submerged lands under navigable impact waters or tidally influenced waters belong to the state of Alaska. And you can see that this is a very robust inventory of federal areas, and that is what this bill is directed towards. It is only considered considering these federal areas that were created post-statehood and identifying those submerged lands that the Alaska legislature wants to eliminate all doubt by planting the state's flag of ownership. If we look at everything that has happened with regards to quieting the state's title to these submerged lands since the date of statehood to the present time, our estimates are that only 9% of the 800,000 river miles of navigable rivers within the state of Alaska have been acknowledged by the federal government as belonging to the state of Alaska. And only 16% of the 30 million acres of submerged lands under lakes that we believe are navigable have been acknowledged as owned by the state of Alaska.
Thank you. Representative McCabe has a question.
Thank you. So when you say acknowledged through the chair, when you say acknowledged, what do you mean like that? Have they given us a title, or is it just acknowledged in some sort of court case like Sturgeon or something like that? Or so how does the federal government actually acknowledge it?
Through the chair, Representative McCabe, I would say that in a lot of the ways that you just described, there are numerous ways that they could acknowledge it. For example, they could issue a navigability determination through the Bureau of Land Management, which is the institution in the federal government that is charged with making navigability determinations. They could issue an affirmative navigability determination. That's one way. Another way that we could get an acknowledgement from the federal government is through the so-called RDI process. RDI stands for Recordable Disclaimer of Interest, and it is a provision contained within FLIPMA that says in a situation where the federal government and the state government agree as to the navigability, the federal government can issue this disclaimer stating that they have no interest in the lands. This is supposed to be our quick and easy way of getting title to uncontested submerged lands. The proof of the matter, however, has been that this has been neither quick nor easy. In many instances, to state, quite frankly, the obvious, we have had to wait a decade and pay large sums of money for that federal quitclaim deed, if you will, to the submerged lands. I will give you an example. Many of you are familiar with Lake Besharoff. It is the second largest lake within the state of Alaska after Lake Iliamna. It is, in its deepest point, 450 feet deep. It has an average depth of 100 feet. It covers hundreds of surface miles. Seems pretty obvious that it's navigable, at least to me. We file an RDI application. It takes them over 2 years and costs us $10,000 in administrative processing fees for them to state the obvious. Yeah, you can float a boat in it. I mean, this is a water body that you could literally have an aircraft carrier do donuts in, And we have to go through this laborious, time-intensive process to get these reportable disclaimers of interest. That's number two. Number three, quiet title litigation, where we sue pursuant to the Federal Quiet Title Act and seek a court ruling that, yes, we are indeed the owner of this. We have had a lot of success with those. On the Kinnick River, the Stikine River, and the Mosquito Fork River are three that come to mind immediately. And in fact, on the Mosquito Fork River, which Jesse Alloway quarterbacked for the state in that litigation, we prevailed, and we were also found, rather the BLM was and DOJ were found to have acted in bad faith, and we were awarded our attorney's fees and costs in that case. So we have a lot of success. But litigation takes a long time. And so if we look at the graphic before us on the screen right now, 9% and 16%, to bring that to 100%, as Deputy Commissioner Goodrum just said, is going to take decades, if not centuries, and is going to cost tens of millions of dollars. House Bill 397, we submit, provides a way where the state can say, enough is enough. We've been patient for 63-plus years to have this these resolved. We are going to move that process forward, identify what submerged lands belong to the state within these federal areas, and we are going to act like the owners that we truly are.
Any follow-up? Representative Vance has a question.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, you mentioned $10,000 for every request, and is that per lake, per stream? So you've listed just in this bill packet about 1,800, more than that, and then there will be more later. So $10,000 and a lengthy process every time?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, yes. We thought by proceeding with Lake Basharoff, let's pick one that is just glaringly obvious. Let's give them an opportunity to come in ahead of schedule and under budget on these RDIs. We could not think of a water body that was more clear cut. And that's what it cost us for something that large. If we are looking at something less than that, you can expect far longer than 2 years for the BLM to complete its navigability determinations, and their administrative costs are going to be much higher. For example, we sought an RDI for the Stikine River, which many of you in Southeast are very familiar with, a very large, historic, roaring river in these parts. And between the RDI process, which ultimately stalled, forcing us to resort to quiet title litigation, it took well over a decade for us to get an affirmative court declaration that the Stikine River is navigable. This is what House Bill 397 is trying to expedite. We have applied the same meticulous assessment to all of the water bodies within the federal areas that fall within the purview of this legislation to identify those cases that we believe we will be successful in court if we have to litigate this question. And to go ahead and reset the presumption. Presently, the federal land managers take the position that if there has not been an affirmative declaration by BLM, the default is it's not navigable. And we say, pursuant to the equal footing doctrine through House Bill 397, we are going to assess and proclaim boldly our ownership of rivers that should be presumptively deemed navigable if the court process or the administrative process is going to wind its way to conclusion.
Follow up. So, for the record, could you clarify how would passing a state law declaring these as state submerged navigable waters help us in federal court?
Through the chair, Representative Vance. I'm going to ask Jesse Alloway to weigh in on this as well, but in the short answer I would give you is that we are going through House Bill 397 to actively manage these state submerged lands as the owners that we truly are. We are going to plant the flag, just as we saw in the Sturgeon litigation in these areas. And if federal authorities do not like the way we are managing this, they can certainly bring suit against us as the landowners. So I believe that a strong declaration by the Alaska legislature that we own this will send the word out to both the general public, friend and foe alike, if you will, that these are state lands and that you will, if necessary, comply with state law when using these lands, and not to presume that you, being the federal government, own these lands. Does that answer your question, Representative?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Walker, I have a follow-up to that. So in terms of thinking about how this process works, we often talk about the land selection process and how similarly it's been more than 63 years since that process has been completed. As I understand it, it has a lot to do with just sort of like the complexity of the process and that things are challenged as they go through. I mean, I know for the land selection part of it, for example, the state has selected lands that Native corporations have also selected, and so there's that kind of dispute to be resolved. Why is there a delay in this circumstance? Is it similar in that there, you know, are these overlapping like jurisdictional claims, or is it just truly we've never like fully resolved the process?
Chair Tarr, I would answer your question by first, this is going to be separate from the land selection process. Obviously, these are federal areas that have been withdrawn. Further, the title to the submerged lands passed to the state outside of the land selection process. Pursuant to the equal footing doctrine, our title to those submerged lands vested as of the date of statehood. So they are not part of the land selection process. However, to your question of why is this taking so long? Good question. That is something that the state has been actively pushing for years now through the litigation process and otherwise. And it takes a long time to wind its way to conclusion, particularly if your federal counterparts are dragging their feet. If they have no desire to consult with, to involve the state of Alaska as an adjoining landowner or as a landowner that owns lands within federal boundaries, it is far easier, I think, in many land managers, federal land managers' mind, to follow the process that they do in the lower 48, where you draw a boundary around it. And if it's within the boundaries, you own it. Alaska's different in this and in so many other things. Here, we have inholdings within federal areas, and likewise, we have large tracts of state submerged lands. As a result, particularly when you're dealing with these federal parks and preserves, there is a belief, I think, with certain federal land managers, let's just leave status quo as is. Let's keep kicking the can down the road because it is going to make it a lot more difficult if we have to confer with and involve the state of Alaska as a separate sovereign in resolving these land management issues.
Okay. And then thank you. I appreciate that. And the ones that you mentioned previously, Knick River, the Stikine, and then the Mosquito Fork River. How recently were those matters resolved? Have that, in this more recent sort of effort or iteration, are those the things you've most recently worked on?
Chair Tarr, we have numerous pending cases. For example, we are engaged in litigation with the federal government over the North Fork and the Middle Fork of the 40 Mile River. We are likewise involved in litigation with the federal government over the Middle Fork of the Koyukuk River, the Bettles River, and the Dietrich River. We have also given 180-day notice, which you are required under the Federal Quiet Title Act to give that notice before you can sue. We have given notice on the Mulchotna River, the Chilicadrotna River, Twin Lakes, and Turquoise Lake within Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. And there's other ones as well where we have expired 180-day notices that we are intending to initiate litigation in the immediate future. So we have a lot of pending litigation. In answer to your question about the inventory of cases that have been recently decided, obviously the Mosquito Fork, the Knick River, the Stikine River, Brent, what are some of the other ones? There are others. I'm sorry. It's just they're escaping me at the moment right now. We have also encountered with our RDI program that we have yet to see any substantive movement on any of our numerous pending RDI applications in well over 2 years. Substantive movement at all. In one case, regarding the Arolic River, where we have asked for an RDI, it has been over 5 years where they explain that they have been working on preparing a notice for the Federal Register. Literally, a notice for the Federal Register we have been waiting on for the better part of 5 years. There is enormous foot dragging on all of this, and that is one of the areas where we believe that House Bill 397 is helpful to us. Is it going to resolve all of our issues? No, it will not. However, to use a baseball analogy, we consider it a solid base hit.
Okay.
Again, much of the impetus for what we're outlining today and the impetus for House Bill 397 is based upon the Sturgeon litigation, which, as everyone on this committee well knows, it was a case in which the United States Supreme Court unanimously ruled twice in John Sturgeon's favor concerning his usage of the Nation River. And it ruled unanimously that federal regulations do not supersede state ownership and management of navigable waters in Anilka CSUs, or conservation system units. On the screen before you with this bubble chart, you'll see the larger strategy of all of the things that the Department of Natural Resources is doing to address this problem, to act in a way that we at long last see this fundamental promise of statehood achieved. And we've talked about several of these today. We've talked about, you'll see at 12 o'clock, intensifying quiet title litigation against the federal government. We have also been very active in creating expanded databases that are available to the public that outline those waters in federal areas that we consider, we being the Department of Natural Resources, believe to be navigable and believe that we would prevail in litigation concerning. We have been very actively managing state-owned submerged lands in federal areas. We are, in essence, acting like the owners that we truly are. And highlighted on this bubble chart, you will see how we believe that this codification effort contained within House Bill 397 and its companion Senate Bill 227 work together to advance. So if we look at the legislation specifically and what it does, you'll see it's a rather lengthy bill. I think it is very lengthy, approximately 80 pages, largely because of the list, the very specific list of waters that are identified in there. The rest of the bill is fairly straightforward. It codifies state ownership, management, and control of the navigable waters and submerged lands within federal areas that are not covered by a valid pre-statehood withdrawal that explicitly defeat state title. It identifies all of those rivers with great specificity that we believe belong to the state of Alaska and the submerged lands associated with them. We also set forth some example, just some example, susceptibility criteria that is derived from case law that we, the Department of Natural Resources, would use in making our navigability determinations. Now, under this bill, because doing all federal areas, all post-statehood federal areas in the state of Alaska is a Herculean task, we have divided it up. Within this particular House bill, this first phase, we have done the work, the navigability assessments, for all National Park Service areas statewide and the Tongass National Forest. That's phase one. The bill contains a reporting requirement. So we are hopeful, if this bill passes, that we will come before you at the next legislative session and report to you waters that are contained within U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service refuges, as well as in the Chugach National Forest, and ask you to amend this legislation, amend the statute to add those additional navigable, in fact, waters, and tidally influenced waters within those boundaries. The third phase, we would complete our work with U.S. Fish and Wildlife refuges, and we would begin the work on BLM lands. And then the fourth phase of this work would be an ongoing process of clarification, modification, and amendment as necessary. For instance, while all of this is going on, we are actively pursuing litigation. If we have an outcome in that litigation that is more expansive than the description of the river that is contained within this bill, we would be asking the Alaska House and the Alaska Senate to amend to include that court decision in its full breadth. If we were to lose, we would likewise want the public to understand that we have lost, but we have enormous confidence in this, that we have lost, so that they could conform their conduct accordingly to make sure that they were not acting in violation of federal rules, regulations, and statutes. Now, if we go through the sectional analysis of the bill, again, Section 1 underscores our state management and control. It lists the specific navigable waters in federal areas beneath which Alaska owns the submerged lands, and it creates this annual reporting requirement that I've just described. Sections 2 through 6 of the bill define the geographic scope of the legislation, specifically post-statehood federal areas in Alaska, charge DNR with responsibility to conduct ongoing navigability research to determine state title to submerged lands within these relevant federal areas, and it defines key terms that are used in these navigability assessments. Section 7 contains the legislative reporting requirement, and it lists the example susceptibility criteria derived from relevant case law to guide DNR in making navigability determinations, including but not limited to the types of watercraft to be used in making and assessing navigability determinations, other principles about documented personal use establishing that a river is susceptible to navigation, and that navigability does not require a clear channel, two-way traffic, and that historical evidence of a river is not required if it is susceptible to navigation. Let's look at how this legislation will look in practice. And what I'm going to do is refer you on this next screen to a snapshot of what our state database of navigability looked like before our initiative, the Unlocking Alaska Initiative, started. And you'll see on this map that there are a whole lot of red areas. These are areas within, these are rivers and lakes within federal areas that have not been determined navigable by federal authorities. As you can see, there's a whole lot of red there. This is what it looks like with passage of House Bill 397. You will see a lot more blue in all of these various NPS areas, as well as within the Tongass National Forest. Now, anytime you look at a map of Alaska, because of its size, it just does not do it justice to try to cram it in onto one particular screen. It is just too vast. So let's drill down and look at a couple of CSUs to better understand what House Bill 397 does. On this slide, we see the Noatak National Preserve, as well as the Kobuk Valley National Park. The Noatak National Preserve is above on this image in the tan color, and the Kobuk Valley National Park is in the green area. This is what the navigability situation was prior to the Unlocking Alaska Initiative and prior to passage of House Bill 397. You can see that only one river in each of these two large federal areas has been acknowledged navigable by the federal government. And they are namely the large Noatak River in the Noatak National Preserve above and the Kobuk River in the Kobuk Valley National Park below. If House Bill 397 passes, this is what those same parks look like. These are the areas where the state owns the submerged lands under all of these navigable areas. Now, I would bring your attention, if you can see my cursor on this, to rivers where you will see, like where my cursor is right now, where it's partially red, pink, and partially blue. And you'll say, well, why is that? We understand that the general public relies upon this map. And not everyone in the general public has the grit, determination, and wherewithal of John Sturgeon to take the case to the United States Supreme Court twice to receive victories. As a result, we wanted to contain conservative estimates of navigability. And that's reflected on this map. If we were to litigate the river, which I have designated with the cursor here, it is likely that we would claim navigability far upstream of this point. But we want the public to have confidence and certainty in our navigability work. And that is also reflected in House Bill 396 and the descriptions that are contained therein. Whoops. So again, just going back, that's what it looked like before. This is what it would look like after. The proposed legislation we see as an important step in forcing the federal government to honor its fundamental promise of statehood made to the state of Alaska, namely that we own submerged lands under navigable, in fact, and tidally influenced rivers statewide. It's been over 62 years, and the initiative behind this legislation is to force the government, federal government, to keep its promise, and we believe that House Bill 397 is a bold step in that direction. That's all the comments that I had, Chair Tarr. I'm happy to answer any questions, and thank you very much for working us into your very busy schedule today.
Thank you. We appreciate that, Mr. Walker. Ms. Alloway, did you have anything you wanted to add at this time?
I just would like to add one point regarding one of the questions of what will this do for federal litigation. And it's kind of like a little nitpicky attorney thing, but we can only bring a quiet title action when there's a case or controversy. And oftentimes what the federal government will do is it won't take a position. So it won't recognize our ownership, but it also won't say that it doesn't own it, but we can't sue them in federal court. And so this kind of like going back to what Jim was saying, it flips the script. It says, federal government, you are on notice that the state of Alaska is claiming these waters. We intend to manage them, even though they go through your CSUs per Sturgeon. And if the federal government disagrees with them, with us on that point, they then have the burden, I'd say, to sue us. It puts them on notice, and then it comes, and if they disagree, they then need to do some work, make their NAP determination, and they'd have to sue the state rather than the state always having to find a way to sue them. So it does provide us kind of another lever to get us into federal court if there's a dispute in the future. And that's the only thing I'd add. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Alloway. Let's start with questions. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate this conversation, and I'm always a proponent if we can have something established by law that doesn't have to go to the courts because it's clear. I think that's something that we should be proactive on. But I do have a question around Section 4 and some of the other sections, but specifically the commissioner's role in the determining the navigability. So could you speak to that? Because that's one of the areas that you haven't really spoken to, is the commissioner's role in this process.
Through the chair, Representative Vance, we have a team of employees, very, very knowledgeable employees within my section, the public access assertion and defense section within DMLW of DNR, who consider all sources in assessing whether or not a particular river is navigable, whether we believe it's navigable, and would we, and assessing whether we believe that we would prevail in litigation if we sued or were sued concerning that river. They look at historical evidence of use, where the river might have been used as a highway of commerce. But as we know in Alaska, the historical record is oftentimes pretty slim, that, you know, we don't have a robust record of folks traveling particular rivers and doing this or that commerce. So with that limitation, we look at other things. We look at aerial imagery that was collected around the time of statehood. We look at personal use accounts more recently. We also look at other factors considering, you know, rather surrounding the navigability question. And one of the things that's very important to remember is that you can prove navigability one of two ways, with historical use or with susceptibility criteria, right? In other words, if we had an account where a particular river was used historically, great, that's wonderful. In those situations where we don't have a historical record, the law says that you can establish navigability through susceptibility criteria. Is the river susceptible to navigate, to navigation, and was it susceptible to navigation at the time of statehood? Well, that might seem like a daunting task. However, the cases say that if the river is in its natural and ordinary condition, meaning it hasn't been modified by man from the date of statehood to the present time, if we can boat it now in a watercraft that is of the type and character that was used at the time of statehood, if it's navigable now, it was navigable then. So we consider all of these factors when we make these assessments of, is this particular water navigable? And we also remember that if we are wrong about this, the state would likely be involved in litigation. Are we afraid of that? Of course not. We welcome that. But we want to make sure that we have a stout case and will prevail, as we have in other cases when dealing with the federal government. If I may also add, you had asked Chair Tarr about some additional rivers that were involved in litigation and contested proceedings. And Deputy Commissioner Brent Goodrum passed me a note and reminded me of Denison Fork of the 40 Mile River, the Delta River, Kisaralik River, and then most recently a large section of the Kuskokwim River that was decided in the state's favor by the Interior Board of Land Appeals, which is the IBLA, which is the administrative appellate body within the Department of the Interior.
Thank you. Did you have a follow-up, Rep. Vance?
I do. One point, additional question regarding the commissioner. Obviously, this is kind of a ongoing mission to determine if something is navigable. What happens if there is litigation on a river that the commissioner has not made a determination?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, if we are sued in that litigation by the federal government, we will put together our proof as we have so convincingly in other cases and prove that those rivers are navigable in that litigation. We would put forth any historical evidence that we had. We would put forth current evidence that we collected, which might involve both boat travel at different water levels on the particular river. We would put together, and this has been highly effective in our proof, put together a robust ArcGIS package that includes a lot of drone or unmanned aerial system imagery showing us boating the river in what are meaningfully similar boats to traditional and customary watercraft in use at the time of statehood in Alaska. So, you know, we're well equipped to deal with that litigation. The thinking behind this and many other parts of the Unlocking Alaska Initiative is if we get out there and we say, this is what we believe to be navigable, and you, the federal government, have one of two choices. If you disagree with us, sue us. That's what courts are for. We can litigate this and see who prevails in that litigation. By contrast, you could acknowledge that we're right about this and go along with our management of the particular water body. And I would give you an example of that. And it's Crescent Lake, which is contained within Lake Clark National Park and Preserve. Many of you are well familiar with it. Very popular destination. And for quite a long time, many of the folks that are using that particular water have complained about federal interference with their use and enjoyment of the lake. As a result of being denied federal permits to do certain things and other types of what we would consider overreaching actions, certain commercial guides applied to the Alaska Department of Natural Resources for us to issue certain types of permits to allow their usage of this water. Those permit applications and authorization applications were received by DNR, specifically in its South Central Regional Office of the Division of Mining, Land, and Water. When they got it, they see that there is not a formal navigability determination. As a result, they asked of my section, Public Access Assertion and Defense Team, is this navigable or not? We have the commissioner's delegated authority to make such determinations. We considered it carefully, documented it, studied it up one wall and down the other, and issued our navigability determination that yes, it was in fact navigable. In fact, and the state owns the submerged lands. Based upon that affirmative navigability determination, the South Central region started the business of deciding what permits should be granted, right? It makes stewardship calls. It makes other calls associated with making such sovereign decisions. In that particular instance, when we made our navigability determination, it was shared in the permitting process with the owner of the uplands, namely the National Park Service. At the end of the comment period, they came back to us with something we, quite frankly, were hoping for. They didn't say, you can't do this, right? They didn't say, you are prohibited from doing this because we own the submerged lands. Instead, they said, you shouldn't take this action. That's how a sovereign speaks to another sovereign. And that is the impetus behind this is that these lands belong to Alaska. And by passage of House Bill 397 and the other work on the Unlocking Alaska initiative, we're trying to reset that relationship, that we will work together when possible. We will decide things together when possible as separate sovereigns, instead of being dictated to what happens on state sovereign lands.
Thank you. That answered my other question, that how is it applicable to the average Alaskan? And so you answered that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Chris Tompkins is online, and I just want to check in with him to see if he has any questions. Any questions from the table? Representative Story.
Thank you, and I thank you for your presentation today. You talked about an incident in the Lake Clark area where there was some federal interference. Could you kind of give me an explanation of why there might be what has been happening for disagreements?
Absolutely. Through the chair, Representative Story, we've received numerous complaints over the years regarding the usage of Crescent Lake, from individual citizens who go to considerable expense to fly in to Crescent Lake to recreate and otherwise enjoy that natural resource. They've indicated that oftentimes boats that they're traveling on will be stopped for safety inspections by federal law enforcement. Those safety inspections will take the better part of a day. So they fly in the morning. Most of the day is taken up with these safety inspections, and then they have to fly out in the afternoon. We are told by various commercial operators that some of the burdensome regulations and requirements that are imposed upon them by federal authorities are needlessly expensive and in oftentimes unsafe. For example, many of the commercial operators will fly in planes, and they will have boats there that they will take their guests out on, you know, to do various things on the lake. Pursuant to the federal rules and regulations, at the beginning of every season, they have to fly in these boats. And at the end of every open water season, they have to fly them out, right? Now, in many cases, that involves a sling load under a helicopter, which is very expensive, or they will attach them to the bottom of a fixed-wing aircraft and fly them out that way, which is pretty dangerous. What they have sought from us is for us to issue a permit saying that during the winter time, after open water season, that they are allowed to store these boats below the ordinary high water mark on Crescent Lake. In other words, just leave them there, as opposed to flying them in and flying them out every year. That is one of the applications that we receive. And in some cases, we have granted a few of those boat storage permits. Another operator explained that they were continually being, their words, harassed by federal authorities out there, and asked if it would be possible to facilitate, you know, safe passage of their customers from airplane travel to boat travel if they could sink a mooring buoy permit, a mooring buoy, which is a temporary thing, it could be taken in, taken out, but to place a mooring buoy there to which they could tie up their aircraft and boats to facilitate, you know, the orderly transition between air travel and boat travel. Again, in some instances, those have been approved by our scroll office. So that gives you a sample, I think, Representative Story, of the types of interference that many of the users of Crescent Lake are suffering, and the relief that they're seeking, which is very reasonable relief from the state of Alaska, which is more consistent with, you know, the way the state of Alaska manages its submerged lands.
I love
And Representative Story, just pardon me, Representative Kronk joined us about 10 minutes ago. You're welcome to come join at the table if you have any questions, but pardon me for not recognizing you sooner. Representative Story.
Yes, thank you, through the chair. What would state enforcement of all these navigable waters in federal areas look like if this was changed? And I think about personnel and questions like that.
Through the chair, Representative Story. Well, the first noticeable difference would be that John Sturgeon would not be threatened with arrest. You know, he was operating his boat on the Nation River, and he was operating it in a way that comported with state law. Federal authorities said, no, this is within the boundaries of the Yukon Charlie National Preserve, and you have to follow our rules. So one of the noticeable differences would be that with state assertion of ownership, management, and control provided by House Bill 397, is that hopefully we would not see as many John Sturgeon situations arise, that the state would be able to set the management policies for its own sovereign lands. In terms of day-to-day enforcement, if the question is, are we going to see an increase in state personnel patrolling these waters and whatnot, I do not think that we have the budget to undertake a very active management, but we have always maintained the management of the issuance of permits and things of that nature, of making it clear with the using public, you know, when you need a state permit, when you're operating on state lands, when you fall within the jurisdiction of the state, and when you fall within the jurisdiction of the federal governments. What we would hope that we would be making clear to the public is that when you're below the ordinary high water mark, you're on state land. And when you step above the ordinary high water mark, you're on federal lands. That's a messaging that we are trying to work with the federal government to get out there to the using public. And, you know, those efforts are ongoing. But that is one of the ways that I believe that we're going to be managing more effectively, is that we are redirecting folks from seeking federal permits to seeking state permits when necessary, and doing our best in that respect to actively manage as much as possible these state-owned submerged lands. I hope that is responsive to your question.
Thank you. Thank you.
I have a question. In terms of the definitions that are being used, so if we're looking at Section 6, for example, did these follow the same federal definition? So in terms of how we would be establishing what the submerged lands are, that we're all speaking the same language?
Chair Tarr, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, the definition of ordinary high water mark, the definition of submerged lands, the definition of mean high water and mean high water line, those comport with the definitions of similar terms in other Alaska statutes and within federal law. Further, the susceptibility criteria that are outlined in this piece of legislation are derived from the federal case law. So, for example, one of the things that we say is that for a river to be susceptible of navigation, you do not require two-way traffic, right? You don't have to be able to go both upstream and downstream. And that is taken directly from federal case law. And the case there is a log drive, right? Where in states in the lower 48, where they harvested timber and they floated it downstream to market. Obviously, you don't do a log drive upstream. So those types of susceptibility criteria are derived directly from case law.
Okay. And then you have a question? Representative McCabe, and then I'll come back to me.
Thanks, Chair Tarr. I can't seem to find the section with the penalties for the federal officers that violate this law. Are we waiting for that? Or sorry.
I gave up my spot for that. I wanted to ask, in terms of management, so you've mentioned the situation where it was a boat storage permit. Mm-hmm. So I'm just envisioning, okay, so these are submerged lands. We're talking more about navigability and access. You know, once you are on the upland part, as you were saying, that's managed by the Fed. So in mm-hmm. terms of land access and land use, you know, nothing's changing with the federal management regime. So then in terms of our access, are there other examples of permits that you can give besides the boat storage permit that might be issued under state management that would be different from what's happening? And then just to remind us, in the Sturgeon case, in terms of the watercraft use there, it was just completely disallowed. It wasn't a land management question. Well, it wasn't the sense of under the federal management, it was completely disallowed, if I'm getting that right. So I just want to understand, you know, in this transition, how does it look different when the state is doing the permits, and what kind of permits might those be? And just so we can understand that better.
Absolutely, Chair Tarr, and I'm thinking about your answer. I must confess that I am not a land manager per se. You know, I would defer to my colleagues that work in our regional management offices, who are much more knowledgeable about those things than I am. And so, you know, having to speak for on their behalf, you know, I'm a bit leery to do so. To your point about Sturgeon, he was traveling on a hovercraft, which was prohibited from use. That is something that is allowable on state waters. So besides mooring buoy permits, boat storage permits, docks, anytime that our federal counterparts wish to put in infrastructure that would touch state lands, state submerged lands, they would need a permit. Boat launches, other types of infrastructure that they would propose putting on state lands would also be. And I would also be happy to go back to the office and confer with my colleagues within our regional office and update you more because of my own, you know, lack of familiarity with all of that.
That would be super helpful. I think just to understand what it looks like in this, you know, what would be different about state management and what that might look like and what kind of activities could be facilitated in a more effective way through the state permitting of those activities.
Absolutely. I will do so.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Story.
Thank you. Through the chair. It seems like we've talked about many of these cases that are still in court. And what happens if with those all those river disputes that are in court and that this bill passes?
Through the chair, Representative Story, those cases that are in active litigation, they will wind their way through the court system to ultimate conclusion. The passage of this particular legislation will not affect those pending quiet title cases. Now, to the extent that the state prevails, as we are hopeful and optimistic we will, in those various cases, it will have a very positive effect. And we would hope that it would lead our federal counterparts to take a much more cooperative attitude with the state of Alaska, acknowledging that what we claim to be state-owned submerged lands are, in fact, state-owned submerged lands. We think it will have a very positive effect and will likewise inform and give us great confidence in subsequent amendments to this particular legislation if it's passed.
Any other questions from committee members at this time? No? Okay, any other comments that you'd like to leave us with? I think this is just the first introductory hearing. We are going to get kicked out of the room here in a few minutes for the next committee that three of us are on. So we need to unfortunately transition to that as well. But, you know, we just had this introductory committee hearing today. Of course, you know, there'll be an opportunity for additional testimony and public testimony. And so we'll keep in touch. Let me just double check with your colleagues. Ms. Alloway, was there anything that you would like to add as we're wrapping up here?
No, thanks, Chair Tarr. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay. And then Deputy Commissioner Mulligan, I'm sorry I didn't ask you earlier. Is there anything you'd like to add at this time?
Madam Chair, no. Both Section Chief Walker and the Deputy Commissioner Goodrum did a very good job explaining the bill. Thank you.
Okay, great. Well, thank you for joining us today and being available for questions. Thank you, Deputy Commissioner Goodrum and Mr. Walker. Appreciate you coming to Juneau, and I'm grateful that we were able to schedule it at the odd time. Thank you for your patience with our floor work taking up our time today. As we close out, I did want to also just thank Alex Bibi Gadice, sort of, Ivan Knight, and Shannon McCain. Thank you so much for helping us out with our meeting this afternoon. And with no other business to come before the committee, we will adjourn at 2:42 p.m. Thank you.